Welcome to episode 255 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off on SCScoops.com. It is Sunday, January 13th, 2013. I am the Solid Monster. Got a lot to get to this week. A lot happening in WWE and TNA. No fewer than six major stories between the two companies to cover this week. Before we get going here, I just want to say a quick word of thanks on behalf of my colleague, the Swiss Solid Monster. Got a lot of positive feedback for some reason on last week's show, and I passed word along to the Swiss Solid Monster. He is very happy to hear it. He is no longer here. He actually flew back to Switzerland a couple days ago. I saw him off to the airport, and he was very touched by the response from many of you, and he hopes to come back on at some point. I have given him no guarantees of that. Again, he is overseas. I don't know when he's going to be back. He keeps texting me and all this, and I told him I make no promises, but we'll see what happens. But he was very touched by your feedback, and he is safe and sound back in his native homeland and very happy to be there. So I just wanted to give that little update there. Let's get into Raw here a little bit. Let's talk about the main story, which was the first in-ring confrontation between The Rock and CM Punk, the WWE Champion, as the two men prepare for their big match, their big face-off, January 27th at the Royal Rumble in Phoenix. I enjoyed it a lot. You know, it had the feel of a big-time match, which it is. If anything, it had the feel of a WrestleMania caliber match, and it almost, I don't want to say it seems like a waste, but it certainly would be a match I think that could be worthy of a WrestleMania main event, although I doubt that's the direction they're going in as far as maybe, you know, rematching the two of them, but I thought both of them held their own very well. CM Punk obviously is tremendous. He has a certain knack for being able to, you know, he calls them pipe bombs, which is just kind of a little gimmick term that they've now, you know, turned that into. But he really does have a knack of going in there and speaking in a way that makes people listen. You know, he mixes in, he blends in the truth with some of the other, you know, stuff in his promos to give it this work shoot type of feel. He probably does that better than anybody else in wrestling now and maybe ever. So the fact is when CM Punk cuts a promo like this or says he's going to drop a pipe bomb, people pay attention. And when this segment was over, and I'll get to Rock in a second, but when this segment was over, my impression was that CM Punk outshined The Rock. He stood in there, toe-to-toe with The Rock. The Rock would come back with a quip and a funny little catchphrase. And Punk would just stand there, you know, staring him in the face. I loved the part of the promo. My favorite part of the whole thing was towards the end. After Rock was done doing his shtick, and he would waver back and forth from being serious to comedy. And I thought The Rock was very good. Don't get me wrong. But the problem I have now with Rock when he goes out there, and apparently Brian Gewirtz, who you may remember many months ago, was demoted, removed, whatever word you want to use, as being the head writer of Raw. He still technically is with the company. Apparently he was there Monday night. He has always been the guy that works with Rock on his material, his comedy and all that. And it seems like Rock relies fairly heavily on him. He was back working with Rock, as I suspect he will be for the next few months. You know, Rock goes out there, and I think Rock is very entertaining. I was a big defender of The Rock last year, I think, for the most part. I thought between him and John Cena, in large part because I cannot stand John Cena's shtick or when John Cena tries to be funny or do comedy. I love the battle raps, you may remember. I raved about that. I thought that was somewhat refreshing, if not a bit, you know, juvenile. But I was, you know, a big defender of The Rock last year, largely with his promo work. And when The Rock got serious, I played a clip at the very beginning of the Sound Off, episode 253, when I did the year in review. And I played a clip from one of the best Rock promos from 2012. which is before WrestleMania, when he stood face-to-face with Cena in the ring and basically said, listen, I'm, you know, 6'3", 260 pounds or whatever, you know, of man, and I'm going to rip your throat out. When you strip down the catchphrases and all that, this is what I am. And then he walked away. And I thought that was tremendous, because it had a big fight feel. That's what you would do in a situation like that. You don't go out there and cut corny jokes and toilet humor and all this other stuff. You know, you're selling a big match. It's two dudes, face-to-face, who want to beat each other's ass. And that's what people want to pay for. They want to pay to see these two guys beat the hell out of each other. And I thought Rock did very well with Cena last year. This was his first face-to-face promo, really, with Punk. I don't count Raw 1000, because that, you know, that was a three-way promo, you know, with him and Brian and Punk all those months ago. This is the first time these two have really gone face-to-face like this. Thought Rock did good. But when Rock, you know, brings out the cookie puss, I mean, I can't be the only one who just sat there rolling his eyes when Rock said that, because I know why he does it. The people eat it up. I'm amazed, quite frankly, that one of these crowds doesn't just turn on the Rock, you know, when he starts spitting out these ridiculous catchphrases and they don't groan, or, you know, he expects them to say cookie puss and only half of them do. The crowd was into it. The crowd was even chanting cookie puss on their own on SmackDown Friday night, which I'll talk about later. I guess that's the new buzzword. Last year it was, you know, Fruity Pebble and whatever other catchphrases he came up with. I'm at a point now where it's a tired shtick for me. I'm not that I'm tired of The Rock, but he doesn't need that stuff. You know what I mean? He can be funny without coming up with stupid catchphrases like that. So the cookie puss thing was probably my least favorite part about this entire promo. But CM Punk stood there, he took it, and when it was time for him to retort, and he got on the mic, and he got up in The Rock's face, it looked like a bit of a mismatch. You look at Punk and Rock next to each other, it's almost comical. Punk is an average-looking guy, you know? I mean, average as far as maybe his physique is concerned. The tattoos and everything make him somewhat unique. Not everybody looks like that. But you look at him physically next to The Rock looks like a monster, and Punk looks like a walking slinky. So that looked a little bit weird. But Punk got in his face and said, listen, I'm going to the Royal Rumble. I'm going to kick your ass. And he just said that over and over again. And I thought, this is what this should be. You don't have to go crazy with all these cute little phrases and everything else. Just get up in the guy's face and say, Rock, you know, you can spin your little nursery rhymes, but at the end of the day, I'm going to kick your ass. And I thought, perfect. That's great. That was the best part of the entire promo. And Rock, for his part, towards the end, got serious as well. And what I loved about Rock's part at the end is that he did something that not many main eventers would normally do. And I'm pointing, you know, I'm singling out Triple H here, because Triple H was notorious for burying his opponents in promos when he was on top and he was the world champion. And he would go out of his way, whether it was designed that way, you know, and scripted that way, or if he did it on his own, I don't know. But Triple H was notorious during his reign of terror, like 2002, 2003, in cutting a promo on somebody and saying things to really break them down and make them look like nothing at all. Whereas Rock here went out of his way to say, listen, Punk, I know you're a dangerous guy. I know who you are. I watched the TV show. You're dangerous. You've been champion for 414 straight days. That's not an easy thing to do. He went out of his way to put Punk over as a threat, which I always thought is what you want to do. You're trying to make money with this guy. You want this to be a big match that people are going to buy into. Why would you go out there if you're somebody, again, like Triple H back in the day? And Triple H isn't the only one. I'm just using him as an example. Who would go out there and say, you're not on my level, or, you know, he would crack jokes and say, oh, yeah, it's so nice of you to show up here, and it's nice to see you actually having some success and not, you know, losing all your matches or whatever. Rock went out of his way to say, listen, you're the number one guy here. You're dangerous. You're conniving. I've got an uphill battle, but I'm going to beat you. Time's up. So I liked that aspect of the promo. The cookie puss stuff and all that bullshit, I didn't like. And I think that part of the Rock shtick is getting very tiresome. I don't think he needs that. You know, Rock has a tendency, if he goes out there, he repeats himself. You'll notice he'll say something, he'll say it a second time. It's almost like either he's losing his train of thought, or trying to, you know, trying to remember what he's supposed to say. But he's among the best of all time still on the stick. CM Punk is also one of the best. And so I think we have a very entertaining 2 weeks left to see what these two guys are going to pull out. Now, As far as the end of the show is concerned, made sense for Rock to lay Punk out. The last time we saw them in the ring together was Raw 1000, and Punk left Rock laying with the GTS, so I thought that was fine. They've got 2 weeks left to have Punk standing over the Rock, for example, as they may do perhaps on Raw this Monday. I guess we'll see. But I really liked this segment. I really did, for the most part. I really thought this was pretty cool stuff. And it just makes the Royal Rumble feel that much more special because we have a big-time main event in addition to the Rumble match itself. So I'm looking forward to this pay-per-view, actually, quite a bit. Just a couple of other items here from the promo. Punk, early on, before The Rock came out, was talking about some people that kind of... they play into the WWE machine. They don't get the treatment they deserve. He mentioned Brodus Clay. He name-dropped Daniel Bryan, which I popped for because, really, a lot of what Punk said is true. You have a dangerous man in Daniel Bryan, a submission specialist who's out there being called Goatface and acting like a complete buffoon, entertaining as it may be. I thought that was certainly a morsel of truth there in his promo. He mentioned Tyson Kidd as being somebody who's held back, and unfortunately Tyson Kidd was in the news this week because he suffered a torn MCL, it was revealed, in his right knee over the holiday tour that they recently had. He's going to be out of action for up to 6 months, which is a shame, really, because I thought he and Justin Gabriel were a really good tag team. It's not like they were being pushed, but at a time when they're trying to put more emphasis on tag team wrestling, Rey Mysterio and Sin Cara, their future in the company, very much in doubt. Sin Cara is back, although he hasn't been on TV. He's okay now. He had a minor knee operation a few weeks ago, but he's okay. Rey is out with some personal reasons. Nobody seems to know what that's about. So you can't really rely on them. Now we have another tag team that goes down, unfortunately. I don't know where that leaves Justin Gabriel, but that's a shame. Punk also mentioned Brodus Clay, who should be a monster, and instead, I forgot exactly what he said, but he basically said, you know, instead he's dancing around with your grubby little kids in the ring and all that stuff. So that was kind of an interesting part of the promo there. And also, I thought that when Rock came out and started talking about CM Punk's tattoos, the first thought that popped in my head was the irony of Rock calling out CM Punk for having ugly tattoos when The Rock has that thing covering his left shoulder and his left pec. I think it's his left shoulder. I know it's some sort of tribal tattoo. You know, they actually did a feature on it, I think, during the whole build-up to Rock vs. Cena, where Rock went down to, like, Hawaii or something, and I get that. It's part of his family lineage, represents his family lineage or some shit like that. I still think it looks stupid, so I thought it was funny Rock would go out there and make fun of CM Punk's tattoos when he's got this giant, ugly tattoo of his own enveloping, you know, a quarter of his upper body. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But again, great segment. I think the Rumble's going to do big business. We'll see what they have up their sleeves this week. The 20th anniversary of Raw is this Monday night in Houston. Before we even get to that, let me just go back through some other items here on the show, because there were some other noteworthy things without going into every segment. The show did open up with a John Cena-Dolph Ziggler match. Actually, the show opened with a John Cena-Dolph Ziggler interview segment that was just the pits. It was just one of those John Cena interviews where, you know, he makes wiener jokes, and I'm not even going to dignify it by going into it. It sucked, basically. This promo sucked! The match itself was actually pretty good, though. I thought the Cena-Ziggler match was good, aside from the ridiculous finish. And I had a few people write into me with the same thought, actually, complaining about the fact that in this match, you had Dolph Ziggler quite literally pull out all the stops, pull out every big move from his arsenal, every setup move, every finish, every former finishing maneuver, the zigzag, the super kick. We even had Big E Langston interfere in the match and lay out John Cena with the big end, I believe it's called, his big finishing maneuver. And through it all, John Cena managed to kick out of everything. Now, I understand the fact that they've got this story they're building where John Cena is promising to have a much better 2013, because 2012 for him was not his best year, even though he won Superstar of the Year, because the fans are idiots. But he admits this is going to be the year of John Cena. He's going to win the championship back. This is the first big Raw show of 2013. They want to start it out on the right foot by having John Cena get a big win. So in that respect, I get it. The problem is this. The problem is you come out of this match with Dolph Ziggler looking like a complete jobber. And this is after he got that big win at TLC, which was a big win. And it's not like this loss negates that win completely. But you've got far more eyeballs watching this match. Many more millions of people are watching Raw Monday night than they are the TLC pay-per-view. And Dolph Ziggler is in there giving everything he has to John Cena. People interfere on his behalf. They lay John Cena out. It's still not enough. He kicks out, and then one attitude adjustment later, the match is over. 1-2-3, Dolph Ziggler is pinned. And I don't understand the logic behind it. Not that, you know, Dolph Ziggler had to win the match. It would have been nice, but they want to give Cena a win. Fine. It's that even Steven booking that they love where, in the end, nobody gets over. But why have Dolph Ziggler use move after move after move like that and have John Cena kick out of it and then boom, one AA and the match is over? I just thought that was completely fucking stupid. And by the end of the match, I was completely pissed off. Because they didn't have to do that. It made no sense to make Ziggler look like that. Everyone already jokes that John Cena is Superman, and apparently they take it to heart and they really want to book him that way, and I think that's wrong. I don't think you have to do that. I think Cena could have won the match without kicking out of every finishing maneuver, you know, in Dolph Ziggler's arsenal and making him look like a third-rate guy compared to John Cena. I thought that the idea coming out of the TLC pay-per-view was that Dolph Ziggler would now be looked at, if not on the same level as Cena, certainly as being somebody who can hang with him. You watch this match on Monday night, which far more people were watching, I don't get that impression at all. Not one iota. So that aspect of it I didn't like. The match itself was good. Divas stopwatch this week was 4 minutes 39 seconds, which is actually kind of high. We had Eve walking out in the middle of her match with Caitlyn. They've already announced that Caitlyn will get a Divas Championship match against Eve at the 20th anniversary Raw this Monday night. I presume they do a title change on that show to make it a big deal. I guess we'll find out. The other thing here also that I wanted to mention, remember the first time they ever did Ryback versus Tenzai a couple months ago on SmackDown, and Ryback very impressively got Tenzai up for shell shock? Then, because they realized that more people watch Raw, they had a rematch between the two of them the following week, and Ryback unfortunately wasn't so lucky on live TV the second time. Remember that? They did the same thing again. This time they rematched Antonio Cesaro and the Great Khali on Raw after Cesaro beat Khali with the neutralizer on the main event last week. Nobody watches main event, so they figured, hey, let's do it again on Raw. And thankfully, we're talking about the great Antonio Cesaro, not Ryback. And not only did he have no problems getting Khali up for the neutralizer a second time, I actually thought this was more impressive than the first one that he did. It almost looked like he had Khali up even higher and had less trouble, if he ever had any real trouble, getting Khali up the second time than the first time. And to all those who tweeted me asking if that meant that I lost the bet twice, you know, because he did the neutralizer a second time, and if that meant I would be doing another Swiss sound off, nice try. As I said earlier, Swiss Solomonster is safe and sound back in Switzerland, and you know, he's back at home, back at the hostel, actually, that he is staying at. I have no idea when he's coming back, but we do keep in touch via text. They had a Did You Know segment on this show like they do every week. They listed the top five WWE superstars with the most Twitter followers. Of course, The Rock was number one. John Cena was number two. I believe Randy Orton was number... CM Punk, I believe, was number three. Orton was number four. And they had The Miz rounding out the top five. And I thought this was hilarious because The Miz, last I checked, I had to go check this. Miz had 800 and something thousand Twitter followers, which is very impressive. But Zack Ryder has more followers than The Miz. In fact, he has more than 100,000 more followers than The Miz. If he isn't already at a million, he's closing in on a million followers. And it just goes to show you, you know, whatever it is about Zack Ryder, there's people in that company that do not like this man. And Ryder actually posted his final episode of Z True Long Island Story this week. Episode 100, in fact. It was the final edition. I watched it. And, you know, he included a lot of clips from some of the older shows and then had some new material at the end that wasn't as good. But I watched these old clips, and it really was, it was something else that that Zack Ryder came up with here. Very creative stuff. He'd have these little segments where he's trying to climb over a fence, and he says, "Oh, I'm trying to get over, bro." Or he would draw a picture of a dollar bill and say, "See, I can draw money." You know, just this, this stupid stuff like that that I thought was kind of clever on his part. He had a lot of cameos by his dad and the Big O and John Morrison. Even John Cena made some appearances. Scott Stanford became a big part of the show. Primo, Dolph Ziggler had his own segment on the show called Ask the Heel. Very creative stuff that, quite frankly, in some ways was more entertaining than a lot of the stuff they actually show on television. And it's sad that the show is over because it really did help get Zack Ryder over to a point where the company finally recognized him and he started to move some merchandise. He had a U.S. title reign out of it. I've said before that I think Ryder could have been, obviously Ryder could have been pushed better. He could have stayed at a certain mid-card level. I don't think he ever would have or should have exceeded that level because he's a decent wrestler, but it's not like he's you know, the next coming of Lou Thesz or Carl Gotch or Bret Hart or anything like that. He's okay. He's not a great wrestler. And his gimmick is such that he was never going to get to a main event level. It goes to the argument that I've talked about before where people complain, oh, this guy's not getting pushed to the main event. Not everybody is a main event performer. I don't look at Zack Ryder and think, hey, this guy should be in the main event. But anybody with two functioning eyeballs can see the situation and say, look, this guy may not be main event material, but certainly he's over enough with the audience and I guess entertaining enough where he should have gotten a bigger push. And it almost seems like the company is phasing him out. You know, they started cutting a few people this week. They cut Trent Barretta, who, you know, is a name many of you may not even recognize, which is also interesting because last I was aware, Trent Barretta was dating AJ Lee. I don't know if they still are or not. So he got cut this week. They cut some diva from developmental. And with, you know, Ryder's YouTube show coming to an end and the way he's been talking on Twitter, it makes me wonder if perhaps Zack Ryder may be on the chopping block in the next few weeks in WWE. You know, one name that should be on the chopping block, and not because I don't think he's talented, quite the opposite. One person I would love to see kind of escape the clutches, if you will, of WWE is Ted DiBiase. Talk about a guy that's fallen from grace who was pegged for superstardom at one point. No less authority than John Cena once in an interview said that he could see DiBiase standing on the opposite side of the ring from him within 2 or 3 years at a WrestleMania in a main event. And I don't know what it is. Obviously, they did the thing where he was the million-dollar man with the million-dollar belt, and he had Maurice. And you have never seen two people more uncomfortable seemingly to be around one another than DiBiase and Maurice. That didn't exactly work out too well. But DiBiase is a talented guy. And for some reason, he always escapes the chopping block. I'm not quite sure what it is. It's almost infuriating to me that, you know, they keep this guy under contract almost like they just don't want him to go somewhere else. You know what I mean? They're not doing him you know, any charity favors by saying, oh, we'll give him a job even though we're not going to do anything with him. They obviously are keeping him around for some reason, but they don't want to push the man. It's like, either push the dude or let him go somewhere else. I almost hope DiBiase does get his release in the next couple of weeks so that he can go and be productive, whether it's, you know, it's in TNA or somewhere else. Maybe he wants to get out of wrestling. I don't know. But it'll be very interesting to see if any other names get cut in the coming weeks from WWE. So I don't know how I got off on that tangent there. Back to Raw Monday Night, the other big thing. They had the TLC match with Ryback and CM Punk. Just want to say, I thought it was a good match. Certainly not as good as the Shield against Ryback and Hell No at TLC, which I think we really lucked out, those of us who were in the arena anyway. I think that turned out to be a much better match than Ryback versus Punk would have been. But this was still, you know, a very good match. Punk took a lot of abuse. This was his first match back since being out with the knee surgery, recovering from knee surgery. And, boy, they took some risks in this match that could have really put the company in a bad situation. Punk would have gotten hurt, his back, his knee, the way that Ryback, I mean, he took a table bump at one point. Ryback just threw him out of the ring, and Punk just kind of fell out of the ring awkwardly and went through a table. That was a dangerous spot. And Ryback, you know, vertical suplex, has Punk up in the air, drops him just back first down on the ladder at one point. Just brutal, brutal stuff. I was wincing watching parts of this match. But hey, you know, credit to CM Punk. He went all out in the match. I thought it was pretty good. The finish had the Shield interfering, as many of us, I think, anticipated they would. And Ryback had his fingertips on the championship. The lights went out. And when the lights came back on, we saw Rollins and Ambrose on the ladder battling Ryback. And eventually they laid waste to Ryback on the outside. They gave him the triple team powerbomb through a table on the steel steps. And for those of us who remember the TLC pay-per-view when Ryback got laid out through the announce table and he was flopping around like a fish, seemingly unable to get up for like 8 minutes straight, the minute they gave him the powerbomb on this show, I knew the match was over. Punk could have taken all the time he needed. There was no way Ryback was getting up, and he didn't. Punk got up, took the championship down, and another big win for him. So I just wanted to mention that. A big match on Raw, and a very good one at that. I think both guys deserve a lot of credit. So that was largely Raw from Monday night. So now we head into the 20th anniversary show this week in Houston. As I mentioned, Eve, Caitlin, Divas Championship on the line would not shock me at all. In fact, I expect them to do a title change. I'd be surprised if they don't on this show. We also found out on SmackDown Friday night, they had commercials for the latest rock concert. Rock will be back doing another rock concert on Monday night. I have been entertained by these before, but it was better when he was Hollywood Rock the first time he started doing this rock concert stuff. Now it's just so played out, and I don't see how it does anything to promote his match with Punk at the Rumble. You know, maybe they can have Punk counter with he can counter the rock concert by doing a punk rock concert or something. I mean, you know, I'm surprised they don't already have any commercials playing off the whole rock punk music thing. You know, it's a marketing goldmine. But anyway, we should also see some names from the past. Shawn Michaels rumored to be on the show. Ric Flair, I think, is largely confirmed. You know, and who knows? Undertaker, Steve Austin. Show's in Houston. It's in Texas. It's certainly possible that they could be on the show. It'd be nice to see Steve Austin just because he missed Raw 1000 after having knee surgery. You know, I just don't know what you do with him. I feel like him just kind of showing up, while that would still be nice, he'd get a huge pop, I feel like he's got to do something. So, who's he going to interact with? You know, if they're not going to deliver a Punk versus Austin match at WrestleMania, to me it makes no sense to put them in the ring together. You're just teasing something that's not going to happen. Unless they want to do something where Austin weighs in on the whole Rock-Punk thing. He certainly has had a history with The Rock. He's had a little bit of history with Punk. Maybe he, you know, comes out and has some words for both, or has some advice for both of them, or something like that. I just think you're running a risk by having Austin and Punk do something together, because that's going to get people so excited, or get people thinking, okay, maybe Punk's going to lose the title and then face Austin at WrestleMania, which, as far as I know, is not the plan. I don't think that's such a smart thing to be doing, but we'll see. We'll see what they have up their sleeves. I'm looking forward to it. Should be an interesting show. I don't know how many cameos they're actually going to have, being that they just did that, you know, Raw 1000 and the Slammies and stuff. It's kind of redundant to keep putting the same faces on TV, unless they have bigger names maybe up their sleeve that haven't been on television recently. I know Bret Hart will not be on the show. He doesn't want to travel cross-country to these things if they don't have anything meaningful planned for him, which is understandable. So we'll see. Should be a big show. Speaking of Monday's Raw, the New York Post was first to confirm that Mick Foley will be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame at Madison Square Garden, April 6th, part of WrestleMania weekend. WWE has since made it official on their own website. They will likely announce it on television this Monday. I believe they had planned to break the news on TV on Raw this week, but it leaked early, and so they had no choice but to make it official. And what really is there to say? I can think of fewer people who are more deserving of recognition in the company's Hall of Fame than Mick Foley. I mean, certainly there's big names, big gaps in the Hall of Fame. Bruno Sammartino, although that's his own decision not to go in. Randy Savage, of course. And there's some big names that will be going in, I'm sure, in the upcoming years, like The Undertaker, The Rock. Rock can pretty much dictate whenever he wants to go in. It doesn't look like he'll be going in this year. I guess he still could. But Foley has, you know, he's earned the right to go in. He's certainly made a mark, not just in WWE, but he made a mark wherever he went. He made a mark in ECW as Cactus Jack, made a mark as Cactus Jack in WCW as well. And I've seen where a few people, and you know who you are, have commented about, well, you know, is Foley really just a glorified stuntman? You know, I've seen a few people mention that and mention the fact that Ric Flair mentioned that in his book, which he did. Although I think he's since backed off that. Flair and Foley now are actually very good friends. And I always laugh at the whole glorified stuntman thing, because I know what Flair meant when he said it, but it was so disrespectful, and it's such bullshit. For all the matches that Foley has done over the years, where he really just goes in there and takes a bunch of abuse, including the match he's probably going to go down as being most associated with, which is that Hell in a Cell with The Undertaker, which is the greatest spectacle I've ever seen. I can't call it the greatest match I've ever seen, because it really, in a lot of ways, it wasn't much of a match. It was more of a massacre. But it certainly was the biggest spectacle I've ever seen on a WWE or really any wrestling pay-per-view. But for all the matches like that and the big bumps, you know, the Rumble in 99, all the chair shots to the head from The Rock, and the exploding barbed wire matches, C4, all the stuff he did in Japan, IWA, the matches with Terry Funk, all that stuff. For all of those matches, you can point to a bunch of matches that Foley had that were actually pretty damn good. So that automatically invalidates this notion or this argument that Foley is nothing more than a glorified stuntman, because you can point to the matches that he's had with people like Randy Orton. His career was already over, Foley. He had been out of action for a couple of years, and he comes back in 2004 and has, if not the match of the year, it probably wasn't, but certainly one of the matches, great matches of 2004, a great performance against Randy Orton at that Backlash pay-per-view. The match with Triple H at the Royal Rumble in 2000, they had a street fight for the WWE Championship. Foley put Triple H over like $1 million in that match. That was Triple H's first big match where you can say he's arrived after he won the title, was that first match with Foley at the Garden. And that's one of my all-time favorite title matches at a Royal Rumble. It was great. Now, was that a stunt fest? No, it was actually a pretty damn good match. You go back even further. Back in the early days as Mankind in the WWF. He and Shawn Michaels, now yes, it's Shawn Michaels, true. Shawn Michaels can have a great match with almost anybody. But him and Shawn Michaels went in there at that Mind Games pay-per-view in September of 96 and had a fucking awesome match. And it takes two to tango. Foley held up his end of the bargain. He had a very, that may have been the best wrestling match of his entire career. But he had some pretty good matches even in WCW. You go back to 1992, he had a very good match at the Beach Blast event with Sting. There's another match he had with Sting that I had watched once, actually on YouTube. I believe it may have been, I can't remember now if it was a Falls Count Anywhere match or maybe like a submission match or an I Quit match. It was something like that at another WCW show. That match doesn't get as much recognition as the Beach Blast one. But him and Sting had some great matches in WCW. Him and Vader had some brutal matches in WCW, where he took a lot of abuse, but they were very good matches. So Foley, I don't think, gets the recognition that sometimes he deserves as being a wrestler. He'll never be mistaken as being the greatest wrestler of all time, but he was a very good wrestler. He had some very good matches. He took a lot of abuse, unfortunately, throughout his career. Largely, that's how he got recognized. True. But I just wanted to comment on that because there were a few people who were spewing the glorified stuntman garbage, and I just wanted to put that shit to bed because it's just completely ludicrous. And going to be fun for me to be there live to see Mick Foley get inducted. I would imagine that it'll probably be either Jim Ross or Terry Funk doing the induction. I guess they could have The Rock do it, given The Rock and Sock connection. But Foley did an interview once with, I believe, a sports network up in Canada, and specifically said that if given the option, he would probably go for either Funk or JR. JR played a very instrumental role in Foley's career. Obviously, he played a very instrumental role in many of the famous calls in Foley matches over the years, such as the Hell in a Cell match. But as Foley has said before, you know, JR was instrumental in getting his foot in the door in WWE. Vince McMahon was not a Mick Foley fan. and probably took one look at Foley and said, why? why would we even want to sign this guy? Look at him. And Jim Ross stuck up for him, and Jim Ross got him his job, basically, with WWE, and the rest was history from there. So, yeah, I could see JR doing the induction for Mrs. Foley's baby boy. That could be fun. So, Foley is the first name confirmed. I don't know of any other confirmed names. I've heard rumors of people who may be going into the Hall of Fame this year. I've heard Jake Roberts' name floated around, which would make sense. Jake the Snake certainly has had his ups and downs, but he's deserving, I think, of a Hall of Fame induction. And by all accounts, he's doing very well these days, thanks in large part to DDP. I think what DDP has done for Jake Roberts has been amazing. And apparently DDP is going to be trying to help out Scott Hall soon as well, which we can keep our fingers crossed. I don't know about that one. I think the man may be beyond help at this point. So I've heard Jake's name mentioned. I've heard Kevin Nash's name mentioned. You know, look, Kevin Nash certainly has been a big star in wrestling for a long time. He's won a lot of championships. And he was an instrumental part of the success of the NWO, Angle, and WCW, which helped launch that company into the stratosphere. So, hard to argue, no matter what your thoughts may be on Kevin Nash, hard to argue that if you have men like Coco Beware in the Hall of Fame, and even if you didn't have Coco Beware in the Hall of Fame, just, you know, let's be honest here, Nash probably does deserve an induction. You can't just say, well, Nash is a politician, Nash has done more to damage the business and doesn't deserve to be in there. I mean, if that's your criteria, people looking out for themselves, people playing politics, you know, the clique and all that, Shawn Michaels is in the Hall of Fame. Hulk Hogan is in the Hall of Fame. There's a lot of people like that already in the Hall of Fame. That's what these guys do. So you can't really use that as an argument. Nash going in would make sense, certainly. I know they've been trying really hard. Triple H in particular has been trying very hard to get Bruno in there. I've heard nothing new on that, so I assume that's not happening. I've heard the Warrior's name floated around. I don't know. I don't know if Foley is going to end up being the main event attraction or not, but again, he certainly deserves it, and happy to hear it. That brings us to SmackDown this week, one of the other big stories of the week. They changed the World Heavyweight title on SmackDown. Alberto Del Rio beat The Big Show in a last man standing match to finally win the World Heavyweight Championship. And God knows this guy's been trying to win the world title now for an incredibly long amount of time and has failed at every turn. I don't know that he ever won a single match in his feud with Sheamus last year. He just lost and lost and lost and lost. Certainly on pay-per-view, at least. I can't speak to all of the TV matches, but on pay-per-view, this guy was a loser in 2012. And finally, Del Rio wins the big one. They now have their big Latin star. As Big Show was talking about at the beginning of SmackDown, Big Show was not happy that Booker T announced that title match. And Big Show cut a promo on him. And a lot of what Big Show talked about, like, oh, Booker, I see what you're trying to do. You're trying to give the Latin people here in Miami and give the Latin fans in WWE somebody, one of their own, to cheer for. And in a lot of ways, that's a shoot. That's kind of what WWE's mindset has been in trying to get Alberto over as a babyface. You know, Rey Mysterio has essentially, you know, he's passed his expiration date in WWE. Sin Cara has not exactly had a sterling run. I don't know that they have much faith in him. Certainly not getting over on a main event level. Del Rio is their best bet if they want a big Latin star to try to get over with the audience. And even then, I don't know if it's going to work or not. But what this means for WrestleMania isn't exactly clear at this point. There was talk, you may recall, that WWE had blown up some of their plans for WrestleMania, aside from Triple H versus Brock Lesnar, which is still the plan. And perhaps those plans that got blown up included the Sheamus versus Randy Orton match for the world title, which is or was at one point the plan. I guess they could still switch the title, you know, over to one of those guys if they wanted to at the Elimination Chamber. Or Del Rio could even just drop the belt back to Big Show at the Royal Rumble if they do the rematch there. But, you know, then what was the point of putting the title on him in the first place? That really wouldn't make a whole lot of sense if they're trying to get over their new Latin star and they did this big title change and then just put the belt back on Big Show in 2 weeks. Wouldn't exactly make a whole lot of sense. But if Del Rio goes into WrestleMania as the babyface champion of the SmackDown brand, who does he face? You know, you look at the options here, it's kind of slim pickings. You know, Sheamus? No, thank you. That's the best thing I could say to that. I got my fix of that more than enough last year. Randy Orton? Perhaps, if he goes heel. Or I could see them doing a four-way, you know, with those guys and Big Show thrown in there for WrestleMania. I'm not a fan of doing multi-man matches for the main championship at WrestleMania, but the world title is the second fiddle to the WWE title, so they could do whatever they want with it, pretty much. And if the last 2 years are any indication, that world title match, whatever it is probably opening the show anyway, so it really doesn't even matter. The match itself, I thought, was really good. Started out a little slow, built up and built up, as the match should do. And it built to a finale where Big Show knocked out Del Rio. He gave him the knockout punch. And at that point, had I not been aware of the spoilers in advance, which I try to avoid in situations like this, but it's hard not to when WWE spoils their own show on their own website. And I understand why they did it. And it worked, because ordinarily I would not find the time to watch SmackDown. This week I did, specifically because I knew not only was Rock going to be on the show, but there was a big title change. So it worked. It got people like me to watch SmackDown. But had I not known that in advance, I would have just figured, this is it. Knocked him out, last man standing, ref's going to count to 10, match over. And they did something very creative here, where at around the 8 count, 7 or 8, Del Rio rolled under the bottom rope, and when he rolled out of the ring, he landed on his feet. And so technically that counted as him being back on his feet. And I don't remember ever seeing that before. I thought that was very clever. The finish came on the outside. Del Rio fought back. Ended up knocking Big Show down on the ground behind the announce table. He used the steel steps to knock him down. And then Del Rio overturned the announce table on top of Big Show. Now, in reality, I'm sure that announce table for somebody like Big Show, it's like a blanket. He probably could have just, you know, thwarted it off very easily if he wanted to. But, you know, visually speaking, it was a very good finish, I thought. You know, he overturned the table on Big Show. Big Show was already down and hurt. Could not get the announce table off him. Could not get to his feet in time. Ref counted to 10. And the place went nuts. And it was really a very cool finish to see, because the place was going nuts. They were behind Del Rio. Del Rio collapses to his knees. He's crying. Ricardo is going nuts. He's hugging him. It's, you know, getting very emotional. I loved it, because that's what you should see when there's a title change. If I'm in a championship match, and say what you want to about the value of the titles these days, but if I'm in the championship match and I win, I probably would react the same way. Yeah, it's very similar to the way Punk reacted when he beat Del Rio for the title in the Garden when he kicked off his long title reign. You know, I was there in attendance when Punk won the championship, and he dove into the crowd. He was being body surfed by the fans, and even Big Show. When Big Show beat Cody Rhodes at WrestleMania last year to win the Intercontinental title, he was crying. He finally won the big one at WrestleMania. He was in tears. It means more. When you see that it means something to these guys, it means something to the fans. So I thought this was tremendous stuff, and made me very happy for Del Rio, who I haven't exactly been a big fan of late, because largely he's been booked like a nobody. And since they've turned him babyface, again, one of the worst babyface turns I've ever seen. Now, he could turn out to be one of the biggest babyfaces in the company. But as far as the actual turn, one of the worst I've ever seen. So this was quite the recovery to get the crowd behind him the way they did on this show. We also have The Rock on SmackDown this week. His first appearance on SmackDown in 10 years. And back in his hometown of Miami, he had some fun interplay with Cody Rhodes and Damian Sandow. Sandow was great. Actually, Sandow and Rhodes together are just tremendous. Much the same way Daniels and Kazarian together are tremendous in TNA. This is a team that I hope does not get broken up anytime soon. And in some ways, I enjoyed this Rock segment more than I did the segment with Punk, just because the juvenile crap, I thought, was toned down quite a bit. You know, they weren't selling a pay-per-view main event with this match, but I enjoyed this segment a lot. And speaking of segments that I enjoyed a lot, CM Punk and Paul Heyman had a segment on this show. They had done a taped promo from Sun Life Stadium in Miami, the site of WrestleMania last year. Miami, of course, the place where The Rock, back in his college days, played for the Miami Hurricanes, big college football player. Punk was actually wearing, I don't know if it was his actual jersey or not, but he was wearing a Rock Hurricanes football jersey, which at the end of the promo he crumpled up and threw it on the ground. Punk was great. Heyman was great. I love promos like this. I thought the setting was great. Just tremendous stuff, I thought. The other thing I want to just mention about SmackDown here before we move on, because I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but this was the first time I've really paid attention to SmackDown in quite some time. And from the very first segment, it really hit me how much they edit the crap out of this show. How noticeable it is. And how much they sweeten the crowd noise. It's not just the sweetening of the crowd noise, which is annoying, but the jump cuts from one camera to the other. Just in that opening segment alone with Big Show and Booker T, I mean, that thing looked like it was edited to shit. I don't know if somebody, if Booker said something he shouldn't have, if he forgot his lines or what happened, but it was very distracting. I wonder if people who watch SmackDown on a regular basis get that same impression, or maybe you get used to it after a while. But, you know, I understand it's a taped show. Sometimes things go long, so you may have to cut some stuff from the show or cut some stuff from the segment. I know Rock's segment with the Rhodes Scholars supposedly was really clipped, and somebody posted the unedited segment online, although I think YouTube took it down. But I don't know. I mean, to me, that opening segment, do you really have to just butcher it that badly? Can you just not leave it alone? I mean, what if this was one of those Tuesday Live SmackDown episodes where you don't have the ability to edit? You know, they've done plenty of live SmackDowns on Tuesdays, and those have gone fine. Is it really necessary to chop this show up to bits just to get it to look and sound exactly the way that you want it to look? Because, I don't know, as a viewer, to me, I found it very distracting. I don't know if I'm the only one. But anyway, that was my impression of SmackDown. Some other WWE news and notes. There's been a lot of news this week. The other big story that I feel in the last couple of days has kind of got lost in the shuffle here. But if you're a fan of El Generico, if you're a fan of indie wrestling, this is a big story. El Generico has either signed a deal already with WWE, or WWE intends to sign him, pending all of his medical exams coming up clean. I don't know that he's technically been signed yet, but if there's no red flags in the medical exams, he will be signed. And again, there have been hangups in the past with certain guys, most notably Nigel McGuinness, who I'm going to talk about in the mailbag segment in depth. You know, Nigel was all ready to sign with WWE and ended up getting passed over when a red flag came up in their testing, so he ended up going to TNA instead. It was actually him and I think Daniel Bryan at the time were both coming up around the same time. Bryan obviously got in to WWE, and Nigel did not. With Generico, who knows? I mean, the dude has taken a ton of abuse over the years. I mean, his matches with Kevin Steen alone in Ring of Honor were just brutal. I mean, their most recent one was at Final Battle last month, actually. And that also was a brutal match. That could end up being their last match ever against one another. I saw there was a PWG show, I think, last night, or maybe Friday night. I think it was last night. Excuse me. And there were pictures online of Generico and Steen embracing. They were hugging in the middle of the ring. I don't know if they wrestled each other on that show. If they did, then that may go down as their last match. Either that or the final battle match. But again, hopefully, you know, Generico passes and makes it in, because I think the guy deserves it. I've had the chance to see him wrestle live as well. I haven't been to an ROH show in quite a while. I'll be at one in April. But I've seen El Generico live. He's very entertaining. He's a very good wrestler, too. You know, his gimmick is he's the generic luchador, for those of you who don't know. He's got the word generic in his name, which probably is reason number one, if nothing else, why I'm sure WWE will change his name, unfortunately. But, you know, he speaks many different languages, which is one of the reasons WWE was interested in him, not just because he's a good wrestler. I mean, there's a lot of good wrestlers on the indie circuit, but he knows a lot of languages. You know, the company loves Miz for the same reason. You know, Miz can speak many different languages, and they're able to fly him all over the world to do publicity for the company. So that's a plus for him. And a lesson, by the way, for anybody looking to get into wrestling, or if you are an indie wrestler who listens to this show, and I know there's a few who do, that's one of the things that can help get you in the door a little bit quicker if you know multiple languages. And I don't just mean English and Spanish. I mean, there are guys that know English, they know Spanish, they know French, some of them know German, Japanese. you know, all of those things work to your advantage and give you a leg up on other people. So just be aware of that. So I guess the question is, you know, again, what's going to be his gimmick? Are they going to unmask him? Are they going to take the mask off him like they did with Del Rio? Remember, Alberto Del Rio, who is now the World Heavyweight Champion on SmackDown. And there were a lot of skeptics who didn't think Del Rio was going to make it. He had a bad attitude. He's got to adjust from wrestling his whole life in Mexico to coming here to the U.S. And Del Rio was a masked babyface in Mexico. That's what he was. He was never a heel until he came to WWE, and they forced him to take the mask off, which I believe, if I remember, he was very reluctant to do. And it was the best thing that ever could have happened to the guy, because his facial expressions, it's still part of his character. He does the wink and the smirk. You know, there's certain things that you can do without a mask that when you are masked, you're not able to do. And this guy has a lot of charisma, a lot of personality. And so, again, losing the mask for somebody like Del Rio was the best thing that ever could have happened to him. I mean, who knows? Maybe El Generico also has great facial expressions. And if they unmask him, he'll end up being a bigger star. I don't know. You never know. I would feel badly for the guy if they forced him to unmask and brought him up and treated him like, you know, nothing but a jabroni, and he didn't get over, and now he's got to go back on the indie circuit, and it's kind of, you know, kind of kills the gimmick for him if the guy's been unmasked. So if they do that to him, I hope he gets over, and I hope he stays in WWE, for his sake. So I guess we'll find out what they end up doing with him. Nobody seems to know right now. Pretty much everybody who comes in now, they give them a name change because they want to own the name, they want to own the character. And if I'm El Generico, quite frankly, if I think, you know what, this WWE thing, I want this thing to work, but what if it doesn't? You know, maybe there's a decent chance it doesn't work out and I end up back in PWG or Ring of Honor or whatever. If I'm him, I may not want to sign over the rights to the name and the gimmick to them, quite frankly. That's one of the reasons why, for example, Low Ki, when Low Ki was in TNA, he was Senshi. He was Senshi largely because he didn't want to sign over the rights to the Low Ki name to TNA, and it's a good thing he didn't, because now he's able to work as Low Ki in Japan and wherever else he wants to work. In WWE, he was Caval. Some people just don't want to give them, they don't want to give it up, and I don't blame them for it, because if there's a chance they may end up back on the indie scene, they want to be able to own their own character and not have to start all over again or go by their real name. So we'll see what they do with Generico. I really like what Triple H is doing with developmental. It's, you know, developmental, NXT, it's his baby right now. He is in charge of it, and you know, he's made a lot of changes. They have their whole setup over there at Full Sail University with their little studio over there. It's really nice. Really nice setup they have down there. They're doing more, I feel, now with developmental to focus on it than they did even just a couple of years ago, because I think they recognize the fact that, shit, we need guys. You know, because, again, those big names are not around anymore. Chris Jericho's not around all the time. Triple H ain't around. Undertaker wrestles once a year. Rock will come back, but eventually Rock is going to be gone again. And we need to get these new guys over. And I'm not just talking John Cena and Randy Orton here. I'm talking CM Punk. I'm talking Daniel Bryan. They see that, you know, we've got these guys on the indie scene. These guys are pretty good. Whereas the mentality before was never like that. The mentality before from Triple H and others was, these guys don't know how to wrestle. These guys don't know how to work, you know, the WWE style. They're in there doing flips and dives and all this stuff. I used to hear, because Daniel Bryan, when he was Bryan Danielson on the indie scene, people would call him the best wrestler in the world. And for a time, he may well have been. And I remember hearing stories or reading stories, you know, that guys like Triple H, for example. Triple H may have even been asked about that. There was an interview that Triple H did, and he didn't mention Bryan Danielson specifically, but he kind of mentioned, he was talking about indie wrestling and how, you know, it's one thing for people on such a low level to look at you as being the best wrestler in the world, but when you're in the big time, it's very different. And he's not wrong necessarily in that mentality, but you could see where now I think the tide has turned, and they kind of look at these guys now from Ring of Honor, for example, and say, these guys are pretty good. These guys know how to work, or we can work with this. You know, we can mold them into what we want a WWE star to be. And so we've seen guys from Generico now to The Shield, you know, guys like Rollins and Ambrose, Daniel Bryan, CM Punk are perhaps the biggest examples of that. And it's cool. it's very cool to see because these guys are very talented. They deserve an opportunity. They're very good wrestlers. But I will say this, and the Generico story really drove this point home for me personally. As WWE continues to sign more of these former ROH talents, it makes Colt Cabana being a free agent that much more puzzling to me. Especially when you consider the fact that he is best friends with one of the biggest stars in WWE. Colt Cabana and CM Punk are like this. They're best buds. CM Punk is the WWE champion. The company has bent over backwards to make Punk as happy as he can be. You know, buying the rights to the Cult of Personality theme and giving him his own tour bus and all the things they've done for him. And yet, even still, the fact that Punk can't use that influence to get his friend. And it's not like he's just getting his friend a job and his friend is not talented. It's not like this nepotism that we've seen in wrestling over the decades where you have a promoter, for example, and he wants to push his son, but his son is not really all that good. We've seen that time and time again. This is a case where Colt Cabana is a legitimately talented, entertaining wrestling personality who deserves a shot in WWE. He had a shot once as Scotty Goldman. I don't recall him doing anything to really botch that up. The company just ended up firing him. They got rid of him. But he proved that he can be very entertaining because before he got cut, they gave him his own YouTube show, which apparently was doing very well. And it wasn't enough, unfortunately, like Zack Ryder and his show, to save his job. But Colt Cabana is a guy who deserves a chance. He's a great wrestler. He's extremely entertaining, which is what boggles my mind even more. It's not just that he's a good wrestler. He's got that, you know, he's a character. He fits in perfectly with what WWE would be looking for. He can do a mid-card comedy gimmick and get it over and be very good at it. I mean, my idea for example, back when Punk was carrying the Money in the Bank briefcase around, I mean, I thought, why not bring in Colt Cabana and his first role in the company, you can bring him in as kind of a lackey almost of CM Punk, and he can carry around Punk's briefcase. And again, who knows where they go from there? Eventually, maybe he breaks off on his own, but that kind of gets his foot in the door. He can do something with Punk, be a lackey, and that's fine because he plays that role very well, I think, that comedy role. But he can do it all. You know, he can do comedy, he can wrestle, he can be serious when he has to be. He's got a huge fan following on social media. I don't know why the company wouldn't be interested in something like that. You know, Cabana had a tryout match, I think, within the last few months. Apparently, I guess he didn't impress people enough because he didn't get a job. But again, you hear about Generico and these guys getting signed one after the other, all these former ROH guys, Tyler Black, Bryan Danielson, again, and yet Colt Cabana is still on the indie scene doing his thing, and apparently he does well for himself. You know, he makes, I guess, decent money. He's working for a bunch of different companies. He, you know, he gets as many bookings as he can muster. He travels all over the world. I believe he actually just left for a tour of Japan. So he's doing well for himself, but you got to know, you know, that it eats away at him inside, that he would love to have an opportunity to be a big star in WWE. And it just makes you wonder why. What is it about him? What happened? I mean, I remember hearing stories back when he was in developmental about maybe some issues he had with Dusty Rhodes. And then after the fact, I think he may have had some unflattering comments publicly in interviews for Dusty. But, I mean, really, is that the only thing holding him back from being in WWE? Obviously, there is someone or some group of people who don't like him. That's the only thing I can come up with. because when I think of other indie guys that are out there and available who would be a huge asset to the company, you know, Colt Cabana, if he isn't number one, he'd be pretty close to the top, I think, of anybody's list. And he could still do something with Punk. I think a Cabana-Punk partnership of some kind, again, even if he was a lackey or something like that, would be tremendous. I think the two of them would work very well off each other because they're best friends and they've worked together before. And I don't know. I'm sure Punk has put a good word in. Apparently it's not enough. He has the forces conspiring against him in the company. I think that's a shame, but at least in the case of Generico, here's somebody that I really didn't think WWE would have an interest in, and for whatever reason they do. And I hope it works out, and I hope he's not just going to be, you know, paired off as a tag team with Yoshitatsu or Santino. But you know what? Even if he is, if he's making a decent living for himself and he's happy, then in the end, that's all that matters. Speaking of developmental, another news item I wanted to make mention of here. I've seen reports online, including SEScoops.com, that Billy Gunn has replaced Bill DeMott as the head trainer down in NXT. I don't know if this is confirmed or not, so I'm treating it as a rumor until I hear otherwise. But this move would not be all that surprising, given the recent controversy that exposed some, shall we say, questionable behavior under DeMott's watch that surfaced from a couple of years back. Namely, the Naked Jelly Donut Stink Face incident involving Drew Hankinson and Zack Ryder. Yes, Doc from Aces and Eights backed that ass up right into Zack Ryder's face. Jelly Donut and all, just to get out of wrestling training for a day. That's the story. That was the bet that was allegedly made. If you do this, you don't have to, you get out of training for a day. That was the bet. And I know a thing or two about making bets, unfortunately. How bad of a trainer do you have to be that people are that desperate to get out of training for one day? That's like trying to get out of school for one day. Your teacher is so horrible, you're willing to do anything to get out of class that day. How bad do you have to be that one would even think of doing something like that? There's been plenty of stories about DeMott over the years being unsafe and being unprofessional for training guys way too hard, and then they turn around, they get injured. He got fired years ago as a head trainer for WWE's second developmental territory. They had OVW, and then they had Deep South Wrestling, and DeMott got fired from that position. He was replaced by Tom Pritchard. I'm not sure why they brought him back in the first place, but apparently those sins are coming back to bite him on the ass. That's the rumor. Billy Gunn replacing Bill DeMott. Again, I don't have that 100% confirmed. I'm treating it as just a rumor until I hear otherwise. I know Billy Gunn was recently brought on as an agent, a trainer, down in developmental, so it's entirely possible now that he has the head trainer position. And, Billy Gunn was always a decent wrestler. They tried to push him as a main eventer. They gave him the big King of the Ring win back in 99 and the big match with The Rock that year at SummerSlam. And it just, ever since that match with The Rock at SummerSlam, it just felt like whatever push he was getting just completely fell off a cliff at that point. And I'm not quite sure why. So, he never quite lived up to the push he was getting back in 99. But he was always a decent enough wrestler, former Intercontinental Champion, and getting another chance at life, I guess, in WWE is Billy Gunn. Remember, I always find it funny when guys leave the company and then they do these shoot interviews on the company or on Triple H in particular, which is what Road Dogg and Billy Gunn did. You know, they did that when they were in TNA, when they were the James Boys. Is that what it was? They were I forgot what they were called when they were down there, but. They did a shoot interview with RF Video, a sit-down interview where they ragged on Triple H and the politics and this and that, and they really laid it in on the guy. And all these years later, here are these guys, they've kind of found religion, not literally in this case, although I guess Road Dogg is a religious man, but they kind of find religion, for lack of a better term, and they're back in the good graces of Triple H and back in the good graces of WWE, and all is well. And it's just funny how that works. Wanted to talk about something else from this week that kind of bothered me. Actually, it really bothered me. That's why I'm talking about it. On Raw Monday night during CM Punk's promo, he made mention of some names from the past. He made mention of guys like Bruno Sammartino and Hulk Hogan in the course of this promo, talking about the fact that he, CM Punk, is the greatest WWE champion of all time, not just of the modern era, which is what WWE likes to say. He says that's just the buzzword they came up with to sell some t-shirts. I'm the greatest champion of all time. And he talked about the fact that Bruno Sammartino used to be obviously a big draw on the East Coast, big draw in Madison Square Garden, ton of Madison Square Garden sellouts. He was champion multiple times, 8 years. One of his reigns was 8 years long. Bruno, one of the best champions of all time. And Punk was basically cutting a heel promo on him, putting himself over and saying, yeah, well, you know, if I wrestled once a month at Madison Square Garden, I'd be champion for 20 years, too. And, he said basically his year-long reign as champion, all the matches he's had, all the title defenses on television equals, you know, 20 of theirs. And I thought it was a very good heel promo. I'm sure that on some level he does feel like he probably is one of the best of all time. You know, there's always a bit of ego involved there, but I didn't get the impression that Punk was shooting on Bruno Sammartino or shooting on Hulk Hogan, even if it wasn't scripted for him to say. It was a heel promo, and a very good one at that. So, lo and behold, perhaps we shouldn't really be all that surprised, our old friend, Super Schmuck, Billy Graham, who I've talked about on the Sound Up before, way back when, Super Schmuck has reared his ugly head once again. He took great umbrage with CM Punk's words during his promo on Monday night. I want to read his response, because Billy Graham went on Facebook and responded to CM Punk's promo. And this is what Super Schmuck had to say, and I quote, and I'm going to paraphrase here because I don't want to read the entire thing, but he basically said, "I watched the last hour of Raw Monday night. It was the worst excuse for a show I have ever seen. My agent is tight with Bruno Sammartino. Scott told me, the agent that is, that WWE has been calling Bruno regularly, begging him to go into the Hall of Fame. And Bruno has been polite, but has always said no thank you. Then on Raw, all they did was have CM Punk talk and talk some more. The killer line came when Vince had Punk putting over his 414 straight days as world champion, and then said, you had people like Bruno Sammartino, only wrestled in Madison Square Garden, only wrestled once a month. This was by far the biggest put-down of Bruno ever. Why would WWE have Punk say that about someone they have been begging to go into the Hall of Fame?" Now, I will say this. That is actually a very good point that Billy Graham makes. I thought the same thing. They've really been trying very hard to get Bruno to come in, and Bruno was very sensitive, you know, to WWE's motives. And by doing something like this, that probably was not a smart move on WWE's part, unless they've just given up. Bruno has just said flat out no, and so this is Vince's way of saying, all right, fuck this guy, let's just go out there and say the line. I will give him that. That did not make sense to me. But anyway, Graham goes on here. He says, when that teenager-looking CM Punk made that statement, he was also talking about me, Ivan Koloff, Stan Hansen, and others. Find the rerun and listen closely, and answer me this, my Facebook friends. How can they justify putting down a real icon like this and not get called out on it? Any news sites can quote me on my statement below. CM Punk, I have lost all respect for you for not saying no to the writers of WWE for saying Bruno Sammartino only wrestled once a month in Madison Square Garden. You talk about one of the greatest icons ever like he was a jobber. You should be ashamed of yourself for not having the self-dignity to say no to the writers on that line. That line you delivered indicates that I am a big loser like Bruno as well, and insults me as I wrestled in the same era as Bruno. This only confirms more that I want my name out of the WWE Hall of Fame. How many monthly sellouts have you yourself drawn at Madison Square Garden? Not a pay-per-view or the Raw TV show. Quit talking trash about Bruno. So that comes from Super Schmuck, Billy Graham, who apparently, for all of his years in the wrestling industry, and maybe it's just his old age, I don't know, has completely lost every sense of the fact that, hey, this wrestling thing, it's not real. It's not real, Billy. It's really not. Maybe to you it is. You, of all people, as a heel who made money back in the day as champion, should know this. What CM Punk went out there and did was cut a wrestling promo. But as usual, Billy Graham has to turn this into a story about him. It wasn't just CM Punk insulting Bruno, you see. No, he's insulting me. He's insulting the great Billy Graham. I didn't hear Billy Graham's name mentioned on Monday night. And again, he brings up this whole thing about how he wants his name out of the WWE Hall of Fame. I forgot what it was last time that set him off. But he went on a rant a couple of years ago and he said, I want my name expunged from the Hall of Fame. I regret the fact that I ever went in there. And I think he sold his Hall of Fame ring, or he was going to sell his Hall of Fame ring or something. You know, because I guess he's such a man of great principle. You know, the same man who lied about Pat Patterson and all that all those years ago and threw him under the bus during the whole sex scandal shit and made shit up and then later on had to come out and apologize for it. He's a man of great virtue, you see. Chris Jericho has had a war of words of his own in the past with Billy Graham. He sent a tweet out this week that was great. It said, "Dear superstar Billy Graham, shut the hell up and stop being such a mark. Your pal, Chris Jericho." That may have been the greatest tweet I've ever seen. And it's worth noting, you know, there was already bad blood between Jericho and Graham stemming from something that Jericho wrote in his last book about Chris Benoit's death and all the disillusioned ex-wrestlers and old wrestlers that were paraded on TV in the wake of the tragedy. I did read the book, but I don't remember him naming Graham specifically. But anyway, Graham took great exception to this, as he seemingly does to everything else. And he posted a YouTube video where he claimed that if he saw Chris Jericho, like if Chris Jericho walked by him, he would beat the living hell out of him and then spit on his grave for trying to destroy his reputation. I think he also said he wanted to cut Jericho's tongue in half with a pair of pliers and then watch him bleed to death. Sounds like Super Schmuck, all right. Definitely sounds like him. So, I just wanted to comment on that, because every time I hear Billy Graham complain about something, it just aggravates me. Because what does this man have to be so angry about? The man shouldn't even be alive right now. The man is, he's got a donor liver. His health has been in failure for years. It's nice that he's been able to hang in there and hang tough. I don't wish ill on the man. I don't want anything bad to happen to him. But you would think a guy who has been through all of the things that he's been through, And he told the story, I think he shared the story at the Hall of Fame ceremony back in 04 when he got inducted about, I think it was a young lady who was in a car accident, and so the liver came from her, and it saved his life. And you would think a guy like that would be so grateful to be alive and so grateful to go to these wrestling conventions and meet fans and wouldn't be filled with such hatred and just take every opportunity to bash people and say, "Oh, I wish this, if I ever see you, I'm going to beat you to death and I'm going to watch you bleed. And I'm going to let you bleed out and die." That's a lovely thing to say to somebody, especially a fellow wrestler in the industry. And I thought, that's why I thought Chris Jericho's response on Twitter was so perfect. Pitch perfect and succinct. And really, I couldn't say it any better myself, but I tried to. So there's your Super Schmuck update. Let's move on to TNA now, because for all the big news in WWE this week, there was also a lot of news in TNA. And first of all, as I'm recording this, there is a pay-per-view tonight. It is the TNA Genesis pay-per-view. Just a quick rundown here of the lineup. Jeff Hardy, Austin Aries, Bobby Roode for the TNA title. It is an Elimination Rules three-way match. I expect Jeff Hardy to go over there. Sting will take on Doc from Aces and Eights. I expect Sting to go over there. Joe Park and D-Von, the Sergeant at Arms, will have a match at Genesis. James Storm against Christopher Daniels. Chavo and Hernandez will take on Matt Morgan and Joey Ryan for the tag team titles. Kenny King and Christian York, with the winner facing Rob Van Dam later in the night for the X Division title. And there will be a Knockouts Gauntlet match to determine the number one contender for Tara's Knockouts Championship. It'll be Gail Kim, ODB, Miss Tessmacher, Mickey James, and Velvet Sky. So that is your Genesis lineup. Speaking of pay-per-views, TNA made a major announcement this week. They are overhauling their pay-per-view strategy for 2013 and beyond. And from now on, starting this year, the company will produce only four live pay-per-views in 2013. Genesis, which of course is tonight as I am recording this on pay-per-view. Lockdown, which will be on March 10th at the Alamo Dome, which is going to be very interesting to see how many people they could actually get to come out to the Alamo Dome. Slammiversary on June 9th, and Bound for Glory, which is like their WrestleMania, I guess. That's on October 13th this year. And Dixie Carter commented in a press release. She said, "Pay-per-view has changed so much in the last decade. The traditional pay-per-view wrestling model needed to evolve. And we believe this strategy will positively impact not only the pay-per-view events, but the weekly television programming as well." Where do I begin with this quote? Let me say some nice things about it, first of all. Actually, you know what? Let me say the bad stuff first. I'll get the bad stuff out of the way. It's funny to me to hear Dixie Carter commenting on, the pay-per-view industry has evolved, and we have to change with the times. No, you're changing your pay-per-view model because your pay-per-views don't sell. I don't expect her to say that, but it's just comical to me. You know, the reason we're doing this is because we're trying to change with the times. No, your pay-per-views average 7,000 buys per show, and you're probably losing money on at least some of these shows. That's why you're changing your pay-per-view model. And I think it's a positive move. I think they recognize the fact that pay-per-views don't sell. They don't make them special enough. They put all their eggs in the TV basket, for lack of a better term. They want to make Impact a big show, and usually they do so at the expense of their pay-per-views. How many times has there been a TNA pay-per-view where we have a non-finish to a match or some angle that Mike Tenay says, well, tune into Impact Thursday night to find out? Now, I think they're doing less of that since Vince Russo went bye-bye, which is a plus. But that's why TNA pay-per-views don't do well. I've talked about this before. The Samoa Joe Kurt Angle match at Lockdown back in 2006. When you promote a match that people want to see, people will pay to see it. 60,000 people paid to see that match, as opposed to 6,000 for any other TNA pay-per-view. But instead of going back to doing whatever it was they did back then, again, they got rid of Dutch Mantel, who was apparently the brainchild behind it. They said, well, we didn't like that idea. We're going to go back to the way things are. And so they've never gone back to promoting a match like that. You know, a match, promoting it in a serious, almost fight-like fashion. So anyway, I thought that was kind of comical. But I do think it's a good move, especially if this means that all the shows are going to be on the road and out of the Impact Zone. If you've only got four pay-per-view shows each year, and we know Lockdown will be in San Antonio, I would hope that Slammiversary and Bound for Glory will be somewhere other than Orlando. I don't know that those pay-per-view locations have already been announced, but if you've got four big pay-per-views, you've got to make those four big pay-per-views feel like big shows. It ain't going to feel big time in the Impact Zone. That's not going to happen. It doesn't happen now. It will never happen. Those shows have to be on the road. They don't have to be in the frickin' Alamo Dome, because you're not going to get 70,000 people in there. But anywhere other than the Impact Zone, I think, is a plus. And quite frankly, I know they still make money, but I do wish that WWE would have the guts to make a similar move. I not to four shows per year. I actually think that's kind of low. for TNA, it might work. For WWE, four shows, I admit, is a very low number. Maybe eight shows instead of 12 would be a better number for WWE to shoot for. I just think having the extra time to promote key matches would be a positive. And one example is, look at Hell in a Cell in October. The Hell in a Cell pay-per-view, year to year, year over year, ever since they started, has dropped. The first Hell in a Cell, I think, did very well. I think it did 300 and something thousand buys. And it has dropped precipitously every year since then. This past year, Hell in a Cell did pretty well. For a B-show pay-per-view, the show exceeded expectations. And you can point to the fact, you know, was it the fact that John Cena was not in the main event? It was Ryback. Ryback was a new star. He was over. People really wanted to see Ryback beat Punk for the title. I think that may have been part of it, but there were 7 weeks that WWE had before that Hell in a Cell pay-per-view to promote the pay-per-view. And I'm not saying they used all 7 weeks to do that, because they didn't. But having 7 weeks between shows as opposed to, let's say, three or even four, it's a big difference. And it gives you that much more time to get the event over as something special, to where people will say, hey, this is a pay-per-view I can't miss. You know, Royal Rumble is 2 weeks away. Now, in all honesty, I'd be watching the Rumble anyway. But if the Rumble had two okay title matches and then the Rumble match itself, I might just have to take a step back and say, okay, am I going to get this show or not? It's not an automatic guarantee that I'm going to order the Rumble. Is it worth it? Is it worth the $45 it's going to cost me to order this pay-per-view? But WWE is promoting a Rock CM Punk Championship match, which all by itself makes this a big-time event, at least as far as I'm concerned. You may disagree. I think you're wrong. I think Rock and Punk is a huge match. And for me, that's all I need. They got my money. That, coupled with the 30-man Rumble match, makes this a can't-miss show. Now, if they had the chance to do that with more of their pay-per-views, maybe more people would buy the pay-per-views. So having that extra time does help. So if you cut down, let's say, from 12 to 8, however you want to position it, because then you have to figure out, okay, which months do we have shows? Which is a whole other issue. But I would love to see WWE make a similar move. I know some people would disagree. They think that, you know, they need those pay-per-views. The pay-per-views are special. It's the big climax each month. I get that. But that's because you've been conditioned to think that way. That's the way it's been, probably, in some cases. Many of you are very young. For your entire life, you've only grown up as wrestling fans with having pay-per-views every month. And I'm telling you that it wasn't always like that. And I give TNA a lot of credit for recognizing the fact that for them it wasn't working and they decided to make a change. Now, I'm not sure where this leaves the Destination X pay-per-view, because they have that new gimmick they started this past year. Remember, with the whole Hulk Hogan, Austin Aries thing? Austin Aries had the opportunity to decide if he wanted to either keep his X title and forego a world title match, or forfeit the X Division title, get a world title shot, essentially trade it in for a world title match and take the risk, which he did, and it paid off. He beat Bobby Roode, and I thought that was great. They did a very effective job in year one of promoting this new gimmick. Aries won the championship, and now going forward, people will think, well, hey, you know, whoever the X Division champion is, Austin Aries did it, they've got a shot of winning the world title. And now Destination X apparently is off the agenda. I don't know if it's completely dead. I don't know if it's going to be one of these Friday shows. I'll talk about that in a second. But I guess it may just turn out to be a one-year gimmick. I thought it was kind of a cool idea. And it looks like Destination X may be no more. Now, I wonder, because, you know, Genesis is tonight. It's this weekend. It wasn't like they were going to change the Genesis name. Genesis as a name, it doesn't do anything for me. So maybe they just didn't have enough time, and so this year we have Genesis, and maybe starting in 2014, Genesis is off the agenda, and they bring back Destination X, and we only miss it for 1 year. I don't know. TNA has to they have to announce that. They've made no such announcement, so I have no idea. The other part of this is not just the four annual live Big Show pay-per-views. The other thing is that TNA is going to be airing once a month. They will be on pay-per-view every month. And I believe this may only be in the off months, so not the months that we have Lockdown and Slammiversary and Bound for Glory, but at least in the other months, the off months, one Friday, it may be the first Friday of each month, for a reduced price, I think it's $14.95, they will have taped pay-per-view specials. Each one will have a different gimmick. So you may have one, actually they just taped some of them, I think they just taped one, I think it was called Joker's Wild or something. It's some sort of like, you know, enemies or tag team partners concept. I have another concept I think that's built around the hardcore justice. So maybe they're bringing back the old ECW revival concept for that show. They have, I think, another show dedicated to the X Division. So each one will have a theme of its own. And these will be taped pay-per-view specials. In some cases, these events, I mean, they just tape some pay-per-views now that won't air until the fall. I don't know how that's going to work, but they will be taped once-a-month pay-per-view specials on Fridays. I think they're going to die a death, but, you know, they're going to give it a shot. That's kind of like what TNA did in the beginning when they were NWA TNA. They had taped pay-per-view specials. I don't remember if it was once a week or once a month for like $9.95. I forget. This goes back to the early days of TNA. I'm not as much of a fan as of the Friday night pay-per-view concept, but it can't hurt. You know, you have these reduced price shows, each one built around a special theme, so it's not just a normal show, and perhaps, you know, featuring talent that you may not get to see on the normal pay-per-views. I think they brought in some old school TNA guys for some of the recent tapings of these shows. I heard names like Petey Williams mentioned, among others, so I guess we'll see. But I applaud TNA for doing this. It was a move that had to be made, and it's a move they actually did make. And like I said, I wish WWE would have the guts to also recognize that they are way too oversaturated, and they could probably stand to shave a couple of pay-per-views off that just are not necessary. Some of these gimmick shows, Hell in a Cell. Do we really need a pay-per-view called Hell in a Cell? Is that really necessary? I don't think it is. I don't have a problem with keeping around, let's say, you know, TLC or Elimination Chamber. You want to keep some of them. I don't think we need a gimmick pay-per-view, though, every other month. But that's just my opinion. Let's talk a little bit about Impact from Thursday night really quickly here. Just go through the key. Well, let's just go through the entire show. We had Sting, Samoa Joe, and Kurt Angle come out to challenge Aces and Eights at the beginning of the show. Kurt Angle called for Mr. Anderson to come to the ring and answer for his sins, which was to stand outside the cage last week and do nothing, as Kurt Angle and Joe got their asses handed to them. Anderson came out. He referenced an angle that TNA did last year where Aces and Eights attacked him. They left him for dead. This was before Bound for Glory. Anderson was in the running to be Sting's tag team partner, if you remember that. It ended up being Bully Ray instead. So anyway, it's bad enough that I don't think it's possible for me to care any less about a wrestler than I do Mr. Anderson. I think he's boring. I think he is the cure for insomnia. And now he's proven to not be too bright either. Somebody ought to tell him his anger is misdirected. He should be seeking revenge against the men who nearly crippled him. Not siding with them. But unless this is some part of some, you know, larger cover-up here, some larger ruse, like Kurt Angle being the mole for WWF inside the Alliance back in the day, it appears that Mr. Anderson has in fact gone heel and has joined Aces and Eights. Even more reason for me to hate them now. And Anderson confronted Angle in the ring. He got knocked on his ass and he leapt. And they announced that they would have a match later on. Brooke Hogan was being interviewed by the TMZ dude backstage and said that she would speak with her father on the show tonight since he'd been avoiding her calls and texts all week. She got a call on her cell phone at that moment and apparently it was Mark. She mentioned Mark being on the phone. You know, maybe it was Undertaker. You know? Or it could have just been some random fan. Obviously, it was Bully Ray. I'm just trying to amuse myself here, so just go with it. Kenny King beat Zema Ion in an X Division tournament match. Ion damn near killed Kenny King with his hostile makeover move. King landed right on top of his head. I thought he broke his neck, and thankfully, he got his hand kind of underneath, and it protected his fall, but it looked really scary when it happened. And the match kind of fell apart after that. It didn't go on for much longer, but, you know, Ion went for his top rope 450 splash. Kenny King barely moved out of the way. He still kind of got clipped by the move. Then Kenny King got up. He did a front face drop kick that sent Ion flying backwards recklessly into the corner. The back of his head hit the turnbuckle. Got a little ugly here at the end of this match, but Kenny King won in the end, and thankfully he's okay. Joe Park was on the show. He has completed his training at Ohio Valley Wrestling and said that he was looking forward to speaking with Hulk Hogan on this show. And then he went to open the door to enter the impact zone, and the door was locked, and he walked right into it. And then he turned around and actually said, the door is locked. No shit. Everything this man does is great. I am so happy he is back. Robbie T. and Miss Tessmacher beat Jesse and Tara. Any match where Miss Tessmacher rubs her ass and vagina in another woman's face cannot possibly get a negative review from me. It's just not possible. After the match, Robbie T. danced a little bit with Tessmacher, and then he kissed her. She pretended to pass out as a result. I don't know if he has bad breath or what the situation was there. I like what they're doing with Robbie T., believe it or not. It's entertaining, even though he is just comically large. I mean, his head is so out of proportion with his body, it's just hysterical. But I like what they're doing with him right now. Gut Check was back this week, and it was a bit different. This time they had two indie guys face one another for a contract. They would be evaluated by the judges, who will convene on this week's show and make a decision as to who gets the contract. And the two guys were Jay Bradley, who wrestled on a few episodes of SmackDown back in 2008, and Brian Cage, who was once in WWE Developmental. Bradley won with the Lariat in a decent match. Fans didn't crap on it or anything like that, so that was good. You always run that risk when you put two guys in the ring that nobody knows. But it's not like these guys are rookies, so, you know, it wasn't a bad match. Bradley was booed from the beginning, so my guess is that he cut a heel promo on the crowd during the commercial break. And this week we'll find out who gets the contract. Kind of silly, I think, to have one guy win his match, but then the loser gets the contract. But they're looking for the total package, not just in-ring ability. So we'll see. I'm guessing Bradley gets the deal. To the back, we find ourselves in the Aces and Eights clubhouse. Everyone was having a great time, but Mr. Anderson was on his period and was being all crabby. That's what you get for recruiting him, nothing but grief. The leader of the group had Anderson join him and some of the other members. They went into a different room for like a secret meeting. You know, they actually went out of the way to tell one of the other dudes, hey, close the door behind you. But they were kind enough, you see, to allow the cameraman to remain in the room with them. So, even though it was meant to be a secret meeting. All right, then. The head guy berated Mike Knox after losing his mask last week and said that much like Doc did, he'd have to do something to earn his spot back in Aces and Eights tonight. We had Joe Park come out to the ring. He said he had survived wrestling camp. Wrestling camp. I had a good laugh at that one. He asked Hogan to come out. Hulk Hogan looked to be in no mood to be trifled with. Park thanked him for believing in him, and he was also sure to thank his fellow partners at Park, Park & Park, the law firm, for allowing him the time to step away from his practice and dedicate himself to the art of wrestling. It's awfully nice of them. See, not all attorneys are bad people. Park begged Hogan to give him a match, and he said that he was ready for it. Hogan said that even he needed 2 years with Hiro Matsuda before he was ready, but just to get him to shut up, he told Joe Park he could have his match against Aces and Eights, which, again, will be tonight at the pay-per-view against Devon. I'm sorry, the Sergeant-at-Arms. Keep calling him Devon. I have to use his more menacing title that they've given him. Joe Park left. Hulk Hogan stayed behind. Brooke Hogan came to the ring. Asked her father if he was going to reinstate the suspended Bully Ray. Hogan said no, and he left. And then we got to see Brooke Hogan act. Or at least she was attempting to act. She was trying to cry. And it was the most unintentional funny thing you've ever seen. She could not bring herself to produce fake tears. She put her hand over her face. She looked to be trying really hard to just think of something that would make her cry. But she just couldn't do it. And if I were her, I would just replay in my mind all of my own past segments on Impact. That'd be enough to get me to cry. This was something else here. Jeff Hardy and James Storm beat Austin Aries and Bobby Roode by disqualification. Storm was about to go for his last call super kick on Roode. Chris Daniels ran down for the distraction. Kazarian pulled Storm out of the ring. Storm fought him off. And inside, Hardy nailed Roode with the Twist of Fate. Aries clobbered Hardy from behind with the title belt for the DQ. Aries and Roode then fought over the belt in a comedic way. This is the pay-per-view main event at Genesis, and it just feels like an afterthought with all of the Hogan bully stuff and even the Aces and Eights stuff. It's kind of like Chris Jericho's first reign as the WWE champion. How that felt second rate. That's kind of how Jeff Hardy's title reign feels so far. It was supposed to be Kurt Angle against Mr. Anderson, but Anderson stalled forever. I don't know if somebody missed their cue or what happened, but Earl Hebner looked like he was trying to communicate stuff to Angle. This just went on forever. Until finally Mike Knox came to the ring. He bashed Kurt Angle in the back of the neck with a hammer. He hit him a few more times. Garrett Bischoff and Wes Briscoe and Samoa Joe all ran out for the save. Sting was nowhere to be found. Angle was on the mat for several minutes. They finally stretchered him out. And then who should show up but Sting? So nice of him to show up. What a horrible friend he turned out to be. He challenged Knox to a match, which was interesting. He called him Knox. While the announcers made no mention of his name, I think they mentioned Mike Knox's name in the opening video of the show, but otherwise it was like they were going out of their way not to use that name, which I assume is trademarked by WWE. And the announcers just referred to him as that member of Aces and Eights. So Sting and Knox had a match, and can you guess how this ended? If you guessed that Aces and Eights finally won a match, you'd be wrong. Sting pinned him clean with the death drop. Not that I think Sting ought to be losing to Mike frickin' Knox, because I don't. Especially since Sting is the one facing Doc at the pay-per-view, but my God, can they do a worse job of making Aces and Eights seem completely and utterly irrelevant? Aside from that one pay-per-view match, and I think Devon's TV title win, have these guys won a single match? I can't remember a single match that they've won. And while we're on the subject of ridiculous things, why are these guys still allowed to run around with a hammer attacking people? Where are the cops? They nearly killed Kurt Angle, and they're just standing there on the outside with the weapon in hand, mind you. And nobody is going after them. If anyone on the TNA roster ever wanted to file suit against them for unsafe working conditions, this is Exhibit A right here. This is the time to do it. Sting grabbed the ball peen hammer, as they call it. He proceeded to smash Mike Knox's hand with it. This was after Sting challenged Knox to a match. This was after the match, actually, now that I think about it. He was about to do even more damage when Aces and Eights came back out. And they did not come alone. They kidnapped Brooke. And Devon threatened bodily harm to Hulk Hogan's daughter if Sting hit Knox one more time. At one point, Devon actually said to Brooke, and I quote, "Shut up, bitch." I popped for that. Bully Ray, suspended and all, he eventually ran out to make the save and rescued Brooke. Of course, they went to break. focusing on Hulk Hogan standing on the ramp, because this is, after all, the Hulk Hogan show. We come back. Hogan is in the ring again. He's ragging on Bully, completely unappreciative of the fact that he just saved his daughter's life. And he's talking about how Bully is not the right man for her, and Bully then cut an impassioned promo about being in the business for 20 years and not thinking he could ever love anything as much as wrestling. That is, until Brooke came along. When he's with Brooke, things are different. She makes him laugh. Ray took her hand and got down on one knee, and then he pulled out a ring, he slipped it onto her finger, and he proclaimed his love for Brooke. Please. Did Barry Darso repossess Bully's balls? This guy went from being the biggest bully in wrestling to the sappiest one ever. He popped the question, he asked her to marry him, in the Impact Zone, no less, and Brooke said yes, they kissed, and so we've got ourselves a wedding this Thursday. And Hulk Hogan had this fantastic look on his face, like Sting had just eaten beans and cut the cheese standing next to him. Bully hugged Brooke. He gazed into the camera with this devious expression on his face that just screamed, "Don't worry, I'm still a heel." At least that's how I read it. That's what I hope it means. I've been saying all along, I think Bully is with Aces and Eights. I stand by that prediction. And Hogan angrily marched off, and the show went off the air. I think the real reason Hulk was so upset was because he realized that his daughter getting married means he has to see his ex-wife. That's what I think. I know that put me in a foul mood if I were him. What'd she end up getting from him? I think 70% of his fortune, I think. I guess this also means we get the Impact debut of Nasty Nick Hogan this week. As long as he's not behind the wheel, the people of Orlando should be safe. The wedding could actually be entertaining, depending on who's on the guest list. I'd imagine Brutus Beefcake would have to be there. He'd probably be the freaking maid of honor. Brian Knobs, perhaps. Jimmy Hart. Actually, Jimmy Hart may be doing stuff with WWE now, so he probably wouldn't be on the show. It's going to be very interesting to see if they use this as a chance to really advance this Aces and Eights storyline. You know, they're going to have to have some kind of big reveal that leads right into the debut of Bellator on Spike TV, which debuts immediately after Impact. The non-compete that Spike had no choice but to honor after losing UFC is now over. So expect a lot of Bellator MMA promotion going forward. I'm not even going to be around on Thursday night, so I'm going to have to watch Impact probably the next day on DVR. So I'm going to have to wait with bated breath to see what happens with this wedding. I, in many ways, I can't wait, quite frankly, to see what they have up their sleeves with this wedding. We are way over time this week, but we have a big mailbag that I do not want to neglect, so we're going to get right into it. You got questions? Email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Ashwin Nair is one of our listeners. He lives over in Hamilton, New Zealand. I received an email from his brother, who is not a listener, informing me that Ashwin was recently in a car accident. He is doing well, but there will be a long road to recovery, and his brother thought it would be a pleasant surprise for him to get a shout-out on the sound-off, which is a very nice gesture on his part. So, Ashwin, best wishes from New York. Hang tough, and get well soon, my friend. Dennis writes in, "Thanks for making your podcast. I just started listening with episode 251, and I'm now listening to past shows on SE Scoops. I had a thought, after Ron, wanted to get your opinion. In Punk's promo after his match with Ryback, he made mention of Daniel Bryan and Brodus Clay and how they have to put on a face to be accepted by WWE. So here's my idea. Let Rock win at the Rumble, and that hurts for me to say since I still believe he has no right to get a title match, or have someone interfere on Rock's behalf like Cena or Ryback. When Punk loses, you then gather the Shield, have Bryan and even Brodus form a faction to change WWE to what they believe it should be." Well, you forgot Tyson Kidd in there, although I guess he's out of commission for a while. You know, wouldn't it make more sense for them to interfere at the Rumble and help Punk win if you're going to do that? You know, then he could lose the title in the Chamber, where, in theory, nobody can interfere on his behalf. You know, it wouldn't be the worst idea in the world. You have Brodus completely drop the Dancing Kitty gimmick. Maybe have him drop an elbow on some little John Cena fan. You know, Little Beaver style like King Kong Bundy did at WrestleMania 3. I know that'll never happen, but one can dream. But having Brodus be the enforcer of the group, any group really, would probably be a much better role for him. But where does that leave the Shield? Where do they fit in? You know, where does Brad Maddox fit in? I think all of those guys will be okay on their own, but I like the idea of a Heyman-led faction with Punk and maybe Lesnar as the big dogs, and the Shield, and maybe Maddox rounding out the group. A new dangerous alliance, if you will. I think that's a that'd be a pretty cool idea. Brian from upstate New York writes in, highly unlikely, but with the 20th anniversary of Raw this Monday and reports of Ric Flair being there, say there was an Evolution reunion. Maybe it could end with Randy Orton giving an RKO to Flair. I just threw this idea together as a quick, out-of-nowhere way to turn Orton heel, as it would have a bigger impact than him turning on Sheamus. Do you have any possible scenarios for an Orton heel turn? Well, first of all, the reports are that Flair is going to be on Raw this week to shoot some kind of angle with CM Punk, not Randy Orton. But the thing is, you know, those out-of-nowhere heel turns aren't always the most productive. It probably would make an impact, but, you know, you have to ask yourself, why would he want to lay out Flair? Just for the hell of it? Just for the shock value of it? What's the logic behind it? It actually makes more sense, I think, for Orton to do something to Sheamus if that's the person he's got an issue with. They've been playing that up recently on SmackDown. Best way might just be to book a tag match against the Shield. You know? Orton and Sheamus have both had issues with them recently. Have Orton walk out on Sheamus as he goes for the tag. Leave him there to die. Or he lays out Sheamus with an RKO, you know, which gets the big reaction. Have Sheamus, you know, Shield gets the win. And then afterwards, he lays a brutal beatdown on Sheamus at ringside. He lays him out with another RKO, maybe on the announce desk. I know they don't like blood, but if there was ever a time for blood, I can't think of a more effective way to use it than there. Now, if you wanted to turn Orton heel on the 20th anniversary show and make it kind of make sense, to go back to your original idea, you could do something where Evolution, minus Big Dave, because I don't think Batista will be on Raw, but you have Evolution, you know, Flair, Orton, Triple H, they kind of unite against the Shield. Maybe they book a six-man tag. And then maybe have Randy Orton turn on them there as revenge for how Evolution dumped him all those years ago. You could even have Randy do the whole thumbs-down deal. Remember when Randy Orton got dumped out of Evolution? He was on Batista's shoulders and Triple H gave the thumbs down and then Batista gave him the electric chair and fell backwards. You know, I could see something like that. That actually wouldn't be a bad idea. So I guess to go back to your original idea, they could do something like that. But I think it would take more than just him RKOing Flair. You'd have to play up the whole Evolution thing somehow. Adam Sarpolis, excuse me, wanted to know if he could have a shout-out. So there you go. His question... With WWE doing a throwback episode of Raw a few years ago, do you think it would be a good idea to perhaps one day have a special Monday Nitro one-night return where stars like Kevin Nash, Ric Flair, Fit Finlay, and Goldberg can come back? I would love to see a one-night-only Nitro and was wondering if you could see something like that happening as well. You know, personally, I would not, but I guess it might be cool for an old-school WCW fan. I just, you know, Nitro's been dead for so long now, and guys like Flair and Nash have already been reestablished as WWE guys. They've already been on Raw so many times in the years since then that I think it would just be weird, you know, to all of a sudden try to cast them as WCW guys in the year 2013 and make it feel like a big deal. Plus, you're not going to be able to get a lot of the key figures who were around during the peak of the Nitro days, like Hogan, Sting, Bischoff, even Goldberg probably. You know, Goldberg didn't exactly leave WWE on the best terms, and he isn't exactly well-liked by Triple H and others in the company. It's probably why Goldberg hasn't exactly been given a Hall of Fame nod yet, is probably because of Triple H and DX more than anything else. You know, even the announcers. You can't have Bobby Heenan, who probably wouldn't want anything to do with a WCW reunion show anyway, even if he was healthier. You can't have Mike Tenay. I suppose you could get Tony Schiavone, and they already have Dusty Rhodes under contract. I don't know. I just don't think it would work. I don't think it's worth it. Tyler writes in, I'm listening to the sound of right now, and you mentioned that the Christmas Eve edition of Raw was not the worst Raw, in your opinion, of all time. What was the worst Raw? There was a taped show back in 1997, April 14th to be exact. I went and looked it up after I got Tyler's question. That I remember as being one of the worst, if not the single worst episode of Raw that I have ever seen. It was just so incredibly boring. It's not like they did an offensive angle on the show or something like that. It was just boring. They incorporated footage from two other countries from their live tours. They had done live tours in South Africa, and I believe Kuwait was the other one. And so they build this Raw. It's almost like Raw from three different locations. They had the traditional show wherever it was in the U.S., and then they would go to footage with different commentary. So maybe they had, like, I think Jim Cornette. I don't remember who the announce crews were. But that footage was spliced into the show. The Africa footage was so grainy, it was just awful. Not even, like, so bad it's good. It was just plain bad. So, yeah, if I had to pick one episode of Raw to stay away from, that April 14th, 1997 show would probably be at the top of my list. Alvin from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, Canada, says, wow, 254 episodes. Congratulations on that. I've been listening for the past 220 some odd weekly episodic shows. I remember being in Saskatoon back in 1992 when I was in second grade and saw Bret Hart win his first WWF championship. I was just curious as to what entrance theme is your favorite of all time. Personally, I really like Sting's WCW Starrcade 97 Crow theme with the Storm sound effects and the poem. That was a good one. The original Crow Sting character was great, actually. Personally, growing up at a time when Hulkamania was at its peak, you know, Hulkamania was running wild, I am a huge fan of his Real American theme. I can listen to that song anytime, anywhere, and it just puts a smile on my face, no matter what mood I may be in. Of course, the irony is that that song was never intended to be Hogan's theme. It was actually made for the U.S. Express, which was the Barry Windham, Mike Rotundo tag team. But that's my number one. But there have been a ton of great songs. I mean, you know, Demolition, another favorite of mine. So clearly I was a Rick Derringer fan. You know, Shawn Michaels' theme, any of Stone Cold's themes, any of Undertaker's themes, some of which have been pretty epic. Triple H's My Time, The Million Dollar Man. I mean, hell, I think the Fabulous Rougeau Brothers, they're All-American Boys, is a vastly underrated little gem if you've never heard that one before. I always crack up at the part about Barry Manilow. Yeah, I love wrestling music. It's gotten a little bit better the last year or two. We went through a period, I think, in WWE where the music just sucked. Even in TNA for years, it was just this generic garbage. It just lacked, and maybe it still does, lack the same personality that a lot of those old Jim Johnston classics used to have. But theme music is a very important part of a wrestler's overall package. And for the record, just so you know, Brian Blade has the most ridiculous collection of wrestling theme music I have ever seen. Ridiculous in a good way. He has practically every song ever made sitting on his iPhone. It's organized in folders, the whole nine yards. He is the Rain Man of wrestling theme music, and I love him for it. It's great. If you're ever in the car with him and you're in the mood to hear something, I don't even think you have to request it. If you just think it in your head, he'll start playing it. And if by chance he doesn't have, let's say, I don't know, yeah, Doink's third theme remastered, just go with me here. And you point it out to him, you feel like you've accomplished something. Because it's very rare that he doesn't have something in his library. It's like Outthink the Fink, you know, that Howard Finkel does on WWE.com. But if you point out something he doesn't have, he'll quickly write it down, and you can damn well bet that the next time you ask for Doink's third theme remastered, he'll have it on there. It's quite remarkable. Shamim writes in, he's part of the Sound Off Triple Threat on Facebook, Twitter, and iTunes. He'll be turning 19 on January 17th, so happy birthday to him. He doesn't watch wrestling anymore because he finds the product stale, but says, my Sound Offs apparently keep him up to date. His question is, where do I think WWE is going with the whole AJ Lee, Dolph Ziggler alliance, and where does this leave Vicky? Well, I assume it's just a way to help get Ziggler and Big E Langston over, you know, by having them associated with AJ. AJ's going to end up moving on to some other guy eventually, obviously, because WWE has made it very clear to us that the woman is a whore. She's got a ways to go before she gets through the entire roster. You know, maybe she'll get with the referees next. Although I think that probably would be a ripoff of the Madison Rayne Earl Hebner angle that TNA did last year, so they probably won't do that. As far as Vicky goes, Vicky's going to be fine. You know, there's always going to be a role for her. They have to. I mean, the woman is still a heat magnet. I've been to a bunch of WWE shows this past year, and this woman whips a crowd into a frenzy like no other heel that they have on the roster. It's amazing. So they'd be foolish, I think, to take her off TV and get rid of her. All right, we'll do two more questions here. Ross Shepherd from London, UK writes in, "Dear Solomonster and Swiss cousin, I would first love a shout-out to my fiancée, Emma. We are to be married in August of this year, and the fact that she enjoys, or at least pretends to enjoy, wrestling makes her even cooler. My question this week is that The Informer, in the latest edition of the WWE magazine, has teased WrestleMania 30 coming to a city of, quote, Olympic proportions. Of course, the 2012 Olympics were held in London last year, which is the first city that springs to mind. However, what are your thoughts on this? Of course, The Informer could just be hinting at a former U.S. city, which has hosted the Olympics as well. I don't know how much stock I'd put, quite frankly, in anything in the WWE magazine. I used to subscribe to that magazine for years, but haven't in quite some time. So who knows? I mean, maybe they're not kayfabing as much as they used to, but all I know is New Orleans is rumored to be the front runner for WrestleMania 30 in 2014, probably at the Superdome. And New Orleans is not an Olympic city. And it wouldn't be Atlanta, since they just had a WrestleMania there. I suppose it could be L.A., but I don't think so. So I wouldn't put too much stock in that right now. And lastly here, YZini writes in, "I have been a listener going on 2 years now. You are one of two wrestling podcasts that I never miss. I hate working out, but I'm always motivated to take a run when I have a new sound off waiting on my phone. Have you had a chance to watch The Last of McGinnis? Just got it in the mail a couple of days ago and finished the extras while sending this email. Yes, I purchased the director's cut and gave Nigel $30. No big deal until I watched the actual product. I feel for the guy, and it seems like he had some rough breaks, but that is the story of 98% of pro wrestlers, in my opinion. He comes off as someone that really feels he should have been given something in life, similar to how people describe my generation of kids that grew up winning trophies for coming in fifth place. I bet if I rewatched it, I could tally every time he mentioned the word money and be somewhere in the 60s, which makes me regret sending him $30. It's easy to judge him as an outsider fan, but in contrast to a guy, say, like Colt Cabana, who has similar struggles but seems to press on because he prioritizes the love of wrestling over money, it's hard to feel bad for Nigel." So that comes from YZini. He is referring to the new Nigel McGuinness documentary that he made about the end of his wrestling career. He raised money through a Kickstarter campaign to fund the project, and I've heard some really good things, great things, in fact, about the documentary. I have not yet seen it for myself, so I can't really comment on the film itself, but I do hope to see it at some point. It's a fine line you walk, I feel, with something like this, where you don't want it to come off as like a woe is me, feel sorry for me type of story, or talk about all the money you could have had or should have made. But, you know, you come off then as greedy. Again, I don't know if that's how Nigel comes off in the film. This is only one reviewer's opinion. I'll have my own once I watch the movie. But, you know, look at it from his point of view. He worked his ass off and was this close to signing a WWE contract, only to have that dream taken away from him. From what I can gather, he does finally reveal in the film that he contracted hepatitis B, which is what led to TNA firing him back when he was there wrestling as Desmond Wolfe. They actually kept him around for quite a while after he had been taken off television, and I believe he was finally cured of the disease about a month or so after they let him go. Why they didn't just bring him back at that point, I don't know. Maybe it was Nigel's choice not to go back to TNA. But that was the big mystery at the time. You know, what's wrong with Nigel McGuinness? Does he have AIDS? You know, does he have a brain tumor? Is he dying? No, it was hepatitis B, which I believe can resolve itself on its own. And in his case, I don't think it did, so they put him on some meds, and he's fine now. Technically, he can still wrestle if he wants to. I think he did Colt Cabana's podcast a while back and said that he wouldn't wrestle anymore because of concussions and memory loss. But the point is, it was his choice to retire. But the WWE thing, I don't believe, had anything to do with the hepatitis stuff, because that was discovered only after he had signed with TNA and started wrestling there. The snag with WWE came when they were giving him a physical, which they do with everybody who they are going to give a contract to. So El Generico, for example, if he hasn't already, is going to have to go through some pretty stringent physical tests before they sign him to a contract. So they were giving him a physical, and they discovered how fucked up his biceps were. Nigel suffered 2 torn biceps during his time in Ring of Honor. I remember reading about that. And he never had the money to have them properly repaired. He just, you know, he couldn't afford the surgery. And so now they must have healed up, you know, they healed up enough on their own. But God only knows what they must look like if WWE went in there and said, yeah, you're going to have this taken care of before we can medically clear you. And, you know, he just didn't have the money for the surgery. And so WWE, you know, that dream died a death for Nigel. So I believe that is what happened. But again, if anyone else actually sees the documentary and wants to send in their thoughts, I'd love to hear from you. There's one scene, apparently, where it's just Nigel sitting in his car with the camera turned on him, and he just pours his heart and soul out, all of his frustrations, his anger. It just all comes to a boil in this one scene. It's just supposedly really riveting stuff. It's not a work. It's not acting. He just loses it on camera. You know, thankfully, he seems to be at peace with his role now in wrestling. You know, he's the on-screen matchmaker for Ring of Honor with Jim Cornette being gone. That's his new role. He was announcing for them for a while. I always liked Nigel. You know, I enjoyed watching him in person at ROH shows here in New York. I even got to see him wrestle Kurt Angle at one of the TNA baseball shows here in Brooklyn a couple of years ago. He was a great wrestler. And it's a shame that his career had to come to an end like that. And again, hopefully he is at peace now with himself. Finally, before we wrap things up here, just want to make mention of this. I have been nominated by some of you, which I thank you for Best Podcaster in the 2013 Shorty Awards. And the website says they honor the best in social media. Voting ends on February 10th. To vote, you can go to shortyawards.com/Solomonster. And there they have a little box where you can tweet your vote. I guess you have to tweet your vote. That's the only way. So if you don't have a Twitter, you can't vote. And you must write in a reason why you think I should win this prestigious award that I've never heard of before. So if you are so inclined, feel free to vote for me. The only thing I care about is that I get more votes than My Little Pony and the Pokemon dude currently on the list ahead of me. It's a matter of personal pride for me that I beat these people. I think I was up to number 6 at one point. Now I'm down to number 10. All the little My Little Pony fans and the little Pokemon people, I guess, are coming out and casting their ballots. So if you want to go on there and cast your vote for the sound off, feel free to do so. So that's going to do it for the mailbag this week. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. You can email me anything and everything. That is the address. You can follow me on Twitter @Solomonster. And friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster, all one word. Don't forget to go back on our YouTube channel and take a gander at some of the classic episodes of The Sound Off. Some of the early shows, the lost episodes from 2007, are now up on YouTube. My YouTube username is TheSolomonster, all one word, so that's how you can find me on there. And subscribe to The Sound Off on iTunes. Anytime a new episode goes up, like this one that you're listening to right now, it'll be automatically downloaded for you to your computer, to your phone, your mobile device, whatever it may be. And that pretty much covers everything, I think. So we went way over time this week. There was a lot to cover. And hopefully you are now all caught up on the important stuff. We'll be back next week with episode 256 of The Sound Off. We'll have a full recap of Raw's 20th anniversary show coming up this Monday night. And the wedding, the wedded bliss of Bully Ray and Brooke Hogan. Something tells me things aren't going to go according to plan. I guess we'll find out. So until then, be well, stay safe. Thanks for listening. We'll see you right back here next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster sounds off on SEScoops.com.